Text 51551. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Just a reminder about our 1-2-3 quiz happening after 4 o'clock. We're looking for two of you to take part. Great prize, a family break in the Riverside Park Hotel down in Enniscorthy in Wexford. And our qualifying question today, does Eve Hewson star in Bad Sisters or Good Brothers? Eve Hewson. Does she star in Bad Sisters or Good Brothers? 0818 715 925. That's 0818 715 925. Now, my next guest is a GP in Dublin. He's also a clinical senior lecturer at the School of Medicine at Trinity College Dublin. John Travers leads research on reversing frailty and building resilience as well. He has also worked as a healthcare volunteer in India, Tanzania and Ghana. And he's written a memoir about his experiences. It's called A Shot of Hope, Stories of Quiet Resilience. And it covers more than 10 years in the life of a medical doctor. John, good afternoon.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for having me.
Great. Congratulations on the book.
Thanks a million. It's great fun to put it together.
Yeah. So you'd written a number of essays for various journals and they'd won awards. And obviously people were saying to you, you're a good writer, write a book. Is that the way it happened?
Yeah, it came about a bit like that. But in fairness, over the last 10 years or so, I was in lots of really diverse, rich, interesting situations, different rotations part of my training. And after, or sometimes during the rotation, I just decided to write down what I was witnessing, what I was seeing, because they were so interesting and diverse. And then I found I had a collection that was worth putting together. And thank you to the Orpen Press for publishing it.
A Shot of Hope. Yeah, you have to credit a 90-year-old man for the title.
Exactly. Well spotted. And thanks for going through it. So, yes, as the 90-year-old man left the building following his vaccination for COVID, he simply looked out into the twilight and said, "You've given me a shot of hope." And he skipped away into the twilight. So that's really where the title came from. Yeah, yeah, it was a fantastic moment.
You came to medicine late-ish.
That's right, late-ish. Thank you. Yeah. Older and wiser, right?
Yeah, well, no, because that's important for the conversation that's going to happen after that, because you were in your 30s.
Correct.
What had you done before that?
I studied engineering to begin with, worked as an engineer in the Netherlands in the oil industry, set up 3 clean energy businesses in quick succession, worked very hard, traveled all over the world with that and enjoyed every part of it. There are no regrets. But I had always done volunteering work throughout that time, from school to, you know, the first thing I did after college was work in Kolkata in India. And I'd always had this yearning to work in a caring environment. And I got so much sense of fulfillment and reward from that, that I decided to switch my minor with my major. So what I was doing in my spare time, summer holidays and weekends, I decided, why don't I make that my major pursuit?
And why didn't you do that originally?
You know, it's a great question. Things don't always work in straight lines in life, I guess. As that fellow Steve Jobs, if you've heard of him, said, when you look back, you can connect the dots, but they don't always seem to line up at the time. Why didn't I do it originally? I could have done it. I had a really strong interest in technology and running a business. And I suppose there was a sense of conventional wisdom around that choice at the time. And I just kind of stumbled onwards, you know, progressing up the corporate ladder and enjoying it and doing well. But that that yearning, that calling, if you like.
Sort of an itch you had to scratch.
Itch I had to scratch. It was always there. And in fairness, I invested in it in my spare time. And I realised it resonated with me so strongly in my 30s. In a moment, as we're standing in the baking heat in Ghana, chatting with patients who were telling me very intimate, difficult stories.
So you were volunteering there in your spare time
exactly,
in Ghana.
Yeah, during a summer holiday.
Were you in a hospital?
It was a hospital, yeah. I went out on spec. I had some friends who'd been there and I walked the streets looking for work, frankly. And a hospital took me on. I worked in an occupational therapy department. And really, what did I do? I was listening. I was listening to people, allowing them to express their stories of trauma and difficulty. And they're looking for different endings to the story that they were in. And our job was to listen and help guide them along a path, possibly towards a different ending. And I just got such great satisfaction from that. I came to a realization that what I was doing in the corporate sense was great, but I'd done everything I'd set out to achieve. It wasn't necessarily sustainable either. I was working ridiculously long hours, traveling all over the place. And I said, look, why don't I now take the time to invest in that passion that I've always had? And that's why I made this.
And study medicine.
Yeah, I decided to do it in a formal enough way, because if you're going to make an impact, it's nice to have tools and knowledge.
And you say that in the book, that you want to make a difference, a small dent in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you felt that studying medicine was the way to do that.
And of course, there's lots of ways, as the fellow says, there's lots of ways to the top of the mountain. But this, for me, felt like a good way that I could then apply that knowledge in the way that I wanted to in a caring environment.
So what about financing, you're in your mid 30s.
Yeah.
Had you met Lisa at that stage?
Not yet.
No,
not yet.
So you had no commitments really, other than yourself.
That's very true. Yeah. And so there was an element of privilege and
freedom,
freedom about that. And by the way, it was still a leap. But I have to say, sometimes a leap into the unknown can be very liberating as well, especially if you're going after something you're passionate about that you haven't fully exercised to date. So I did have to fall back on savings. And yeah, I walked away from a very sensible, pensionable job. Went 4 or 5 years without earning, had to dip into savings and so on.
And the logistics of it, like, did you have to do an aptitude test, or what way did it work?
You do an entrance exam for what they call graduate entry medicine. Uh-huh. So UCD, Limerick and RCSI offer this course now. It's a 4-year, so it's a shorter course. And it's populated with people who have done degrees and worked in industry before. It's similar to the US model, where everybody who does medicine has to have a primary degree.
Do they?
Yeah, that's the
that sort
the
of makes sense, doesn't it?
I suppose it leads through people through an undergrad experience. They're a little bit more wise in the world. They've got some other experience under their belt, and you can apply it then. And then it is shorter. So I don't know if I could have done the full 6 years with classmates straight out of school. But so this suited me.
See, I got a sense reading your book that you looked on our health service differently because you had worked in the corporate world. You'd been in places like India and Africa, and you'd seen a lot of the world. And as opposed to hitting 18, getting the 625 points, going straight into medicine, coming out at the end of 6 years, going straight into a hospital, blah, blah, blah. You know, and that's fine. That's fine. And people do great work like that. Mm-hmm. But you just had a different view of it.
Yeah, and there's hugely talented people coming out of the undergrad course, of course. But every single person in the postgrad, graduate medicine really wanted to be there by choice. And there was something very powerful and magical about that. And with great diversity, there was people who'd studied Russian literature from Oxford, somebody who'd studied dance from Bristol, a journalist, an RTE journalist, would you believe?
Right.
A spattering of accountants, engineers, physiotherapists. So there was a really great buzz in the class. And we all brought something to the table and learned from each other.
So you mentioned rotations earlier on, and that's where you do different areas. Like pediatrics or psychiatry, and you know, you sort of sample all of the things. And is that part of the process of deciding then what you want to do when you're qualified?
It is very helpful. You get a taste of everything. I mean, it's really important to know all the different parts of medicine in order to practice even in a niche area. You have to have an appreciation for everything else, because at the end of the day, we treat the whole person. And sometimes a specialist can go down a road of being really concentrated on one aspect of their medicine, but we can't forget.
Do you see that as a problem? Because I see it as a problem because, you know, you're something wrong with your lungs, and you go to the pulmonary guy, and then he spots something. He says, oh, oncology, you go to oncology. Yeah. And then da-da-da-da-da. And there's no one person who has an overview of you as an individual, a sort of an holistic view of John Rogers or Ray Darcy or whoever.
There's no doubt about it, but that the specialists excel at what they do well. And sometimes they forget or overlook the other aspects.
How could you change the system?
Well, in fairness, that's what primary care helps to patch over. And GPs have to know something about every aspect of medicine, not necessarily be experts, but have pretty deep knowledge at the same time. And so general practice is that primary source of medicine, the first person you turn to. They provide that overall holistic, what they call the biopsychosocial, is a little bit of gobbledygook, but that where we look at the full person, all of the aspects. And then as we progress in life, there are different disciplines and expertises that look at that in a very specialised way. So medicine for the older person, for example, they're excellent at looking at all of the different parts of a person's health.
And that's a particular interest of yours.
Yes.
And I know you got world coverage for a paper you wrote on frailty.
Mm-hmm.
And before you wrote that, what made you write it, and why frailty in particular?
You know, it's interesting. So I met a fantastic geriatrician, Mary Trace Cooney, who works in Vincent's around the corner. And I was this...
We've interviewed Mary Trace.
Fantastic, yes. Yeah.
She heads up Tilda, does she?
That's Roseanne Kenny, I think, possibly.
Roseanne,
but they're
Kenny,
colleagues,
yes,
and
yes.
They're in the same similar area.
Yeah.
And I stopped her in the corridor one day and said, is there something that I could work on with you. I was looking to get involved in research. And she said, let me think about it. And 6 months later, I emailed her back. She could, you know, she'd forgotten, in fairness, stopped in the corridor. And she said, would you think about frailty or sarcopenia? Uh-huh. I didn't know what sarcopenia was. I do know, of course. Frailty, everybody knows and everybody understands. And it just grabbed me as something that was interesting to research. So I took it from there. I've spent about 8 years going really deep on it, got a PhD out of it, published several papers. It's very funny. I was doing my nighttime pediatric rotation. And I just wondered, I wonder if that paper I published today, did anybody pick it up? And about 4 a.m, my vanity got the worst of me. And I Googled and it had gone viral. And I was really both thrilled and surprised. But
and the reason so many people were interested in it, I think, is because people thought it was a one-way street, that you get old, you become frail, that's it.
Yeah.
Whereas it's not.
No. And this is a tremendous source of hope for us all, actually, Ray. And I'm astounded at the ability to reverse a very complex medical condition. People think it's inevitable and irreversible, the state of frailty, which is weak muscles and bones fundamentally, and that it's this one-way street. But actually, with very simple interventions, such as resistance exercises and protein, sufficient protein in the diet, we can reverse that process. Most people begin to lose muscle and bone mass from age 30. So you and I both, Ray, should pay attention, and everybody listening. So, but by doing simple resistance or weight bearing,
we were talking about this earlier in the week. Mm-hmm. You know how important it is with a guy who's studied sports science, and now he's doing these sort of gyms that are geared towards people over 40.
Fantastic.
And it's about resistance training and
yeah. And we all knew that exercise and diet was important, but I think the science hadn't really revealed how that state of frailty can be reversed with these very nuanced exercise regimes. So there is hope that we can reverse something that people thought were irreversible, and the effects on people's quality of life actually are profound.
I know you'd be sort of reluctant to talk about this, but you're critical of the health service on a number of occasions in the book. And one of the things which I've heard discussed before is how we triage people in our emergency departments, in that you go in and you meet the least qualified person. And if you hang around long enough, eventually you meet the consultant. And you're asking the question, and I suppose other people have asked the question as well, why don't you meet the most qualified person at the beginning and get it all sorted there, whether you need to be admitted or what needs to be done?
You know, it's a great question. I suppose I wouldn't necessarily class it as a criticism, but rather as a witnessing of
an observation
of what I've seen in practice. But it did strike me that that would be great if we could reverse that flow and get people seen and triaged by senior expertise sooner. Now, I know it's been well thought about in health systems all over the world. There's nothing perfect. It's not a factory. Everybody comes in with very different conditions. And there's reasons why you work up the chain. One is a resource, a shortage of supply of the senior expertise. Mm. And the other is that the junior doctors are learning through all of this experience as well. And they become the senior doctors that can make the big calls. But at the same time, absolutely, even working on the inside, I myself would love to see a deeper think on how we can improve the flow, the throughput in emergency departments.
And it's an interesting read. Shot of Hope is the book. We're talking to John Travers. An interesting read about how you say that when you're doing your studies and you're, you know, doing the rounds and your rotations, that you're thrown in at the deep end, and maybe that's not the best system either.
Absolutely. I mean, and it happens. And I recall in my first weekend after graduation, we, myself and a colleague, were the only two doctors roaming the corridors of a hospital. And that is the system. Again, another opportunity for a think as to how you provide proper cover at a weekend. And I know that's being worked on. And there's people, policymakers and so on, are focusing on this. So hopefully both this and the feedback from patients will enable it.
I mentioned Lisa. Yes. Your partner in life, yes. You have two children.
Yes.
And you met Lisa while you were studying.
That's right. My wife, Lisa, isn't that a brave bet that she that she made to bet on a student?
Well, I think, you know, you had a good old CV there, and a man who's going to give up a solid job to help people. That's quite attractive, I would imagine.
Yeah.
But I'm always interested in talking to doctors about their own medical issues. And I know yourself and Lisa had a stillbirth. Mm-hmm. And does knowledge make it easier or more difficult?
No, it doesn't. You are the frail, fragile human in the moment. the knowledge, it does peel away, Ray. It really does. And myself and Lisa had a baby boy, James, at 18 weeks, and he was a miscarriage effectively. And it was a traumatic, and I'm just to put out there, I'm so grateful to Lisa for enabling and allowing me to share this story for both of us.
And why did you think it was important to share?
Well, in a sense, I didn't set out to share it. I set out to walk through my own experiences, and it just happens to be there. It wasn't, you know, by design. It's just very much part of our story.
Mm.
And it's, you know, each of the stories in the book, they're bite-sized, they're easy to engage with. This particular chapter, I suppose, is about Lisa's resilience and her strength, which I'm just in awe of. And so also, it is, though, nice, because perhaps it's not often talked about. There's an element of taboo about miscarriage. So it is nice to share that. And I kind of learned two things. One is that almost a fifth or more than a fifth of all pregnancies end early.
Yeah.
So we're part of a really big cohort. And there's a sense of empathy and solidarity in that and in sharing. And secondly, we don't often hear about, you less often hear about the dad's perspective. And so it was nice to share that in I hope, a gentle, subtle way.
Mm.
And it's an honour to James as well, to include him in that story.
And you have two children.
Jennifer and Julia, amazing girls. Yeah.
And you describe beautifully, which I'd never seen described before anywhere. I'm sure it's in medical textbooks. But the moment of birth, and you describe this miracle of design.
Yes.
Where the lungs, what happens exactly?
That's a great question. I'll have to dig back into my memory. This was the engineer in me just marvelling at this fantastic moment where, you see, the child's heart is fed by the mother's blood supply through the umbilical cord. There's a little hole in the heart that enables the transfer of blood from her system to the baby's system. Now, when the baby's born, the baby takes its first breath, and the new pressure in the baby's lungs from the new air that arrives shuts off that hole for the first time and enables the baby's own blood supply to self-sustain. But I just thought it was remarkable, this amazing act of engineering genius, that with the baby's very first breath, it shut off a non-return valve in engineering speak to enable the baby to take over its sustenance forever, for at the start of, and I calculate the amount of breaths, so many million breaths in its life. And it's just this little handover, and so miraculous and so ingenious. But, and again, it's so seamless in nature, and nature is ultimately really powerful in that. And so, like, we just have to be so accepting in both in our experience, my and Lisa's experience, but in all of our lives, that we're relatively smart animals. We create technologies to support, and other ways we're not smart at all, of course. But yet we have to just accept that nature is ultimately more powerful than how it's designed us and manages our world around
us. So you're a GP.
Yes.
You're a lecturer.
Yeah.
And then you volunteer as well, still volunteer.
Work Mondays in a walk-in clinic for people experiencing homelessness, and in the afternoons for people who are international protection applicants, so asylum seekers. It's just such a rich, wonderful part of the week.
Mm. So you hear horrific stories, and a theme throughout the book is listening. And you mentioned that at the very beginning, that there's research. You didn't mention this at the beginning, but it's in the book. There's research that says that usually doctors interrupt their patients after 11 seconds.
That's right, on average.
Why is that? Just to move things on, or?
Perhaps to move things on. Maybe it's a little bit of rote learning to shuffle along. I suppose doctors are immediately making diagnoses in their heads.
Right.
And they want to try to get to that so they can come up with a treatment plan. But the interesting thing is that it's really important to allow the patient to get to the end of that story, which on average is only 17 seconds.
Right.
So 6 or 7 seconds later, they'll have come to their own natural conclusion. Mm. But there's so much richness in what they say. So listening and allowing the patient to say
that. And in all the books I've read written by doctors, they all say that the clue is in the story.
Yes.
You know, that you may get all the tests, but if you listen and hear the story, that you'll find out a lot more. Anyway, it's a great read. A Shot of Hope, Stories of Quiet Resilience, John Travers, available now. Luke O'Neill says, a wonderful book. And I see there's a recommendation from Tony Holland as well. So you've got friends in high places. Thanks very much, John.
Thanks, Ray. Pleasure.
Thanks for coming in.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.